This is a real-world cryptographer's podcast, where we capture the history of the field via stories.
Today on the show, I'm very happy to welcome Vinod Paikutanakan. Vinod is an associate professor at MIT, and he's a co-founder of Duality Technologies. Vinod, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Yeah, great to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit how you started working in cryptography?
Sure. I think I started pretty early. My sophomore year in college. I guess I really wanted to sort of do some research for some reason. And I went to, one of the, and I liked sort of math and theory from the classes. And I went to one of the professors in the department, and he said, here's a copy of lecture notes of Shafi and Mihir. At that point, it was a huge, like a 300-page thing. And he said, yeah, once you're done with it, maybe we can start thinking about problems. And we did it, actually. So it was a fascinating read. It actually helped that I wasn't sort of doing this alone. I was doing this with a couple of friends. So we kind of together figured it out. And that's sort of how it started. Cryptography was sort of random to begin with. It was just because that's what the professor recommended. But once you get on it, that's it.
So your PhD was actually on the Byzantine consensus, right? If I'm not mistaken,
okay.
Which is a little bit, different than, I guess, traditional cryptography. And then you ended up going back to cryptography, or how did that happen?
Yeah, that's right. So I originally sort of started like thinking about sort of cryptography. And in fact, in undergrad, we wrote a couple of papers, and one was on Byzantine agreement, because that's again another one of the problems that my then advisor suggested to me. And the second paper that I wrote was a paper on secret sharing, in fact, and that had a sort of a much more sort of cryptographic flavor. So I did both, and I continued doing both when I sort of started grad school at MIT. Just sort of an accident that my results on sort of consensus is what ended up being my thesis. But at the same time, I also was working on sort of more traditional cryptographic topics.
And then, so after you finished your grad school, what did you do afterwards?
Right. So I pretty much sort of immediately packed my bags and went to IBM research in Hawthorne, New York, and that was the group of Tal Rabin and lots of sort of really sort of interesting people, as you know, there. So there was Tal, there was Shai, Hugo, Rosario was there, and Ran was sort of, he had just left, I think, and Charanjit, and Craig was an intern there, and then he came back as a full-time employee. So yeah, it was a very interesting group.
And so you're known as one of the co-author of many of the lattice-based homomorphic encryption schemas and a lot of lattice-based constructions in general. But can you tell us how you got into working on homomorphic encryption in particular?
Yeah. So I guess I was sort of thinking about homomorphic encryption, in grad school already. I'm trying to remember how it started, but we wrote one of the with sort of fellow students at that point. We wrote a paper on obfuscation, obfuscating a particular sort of class of programs, and there, we had to sort of use this homomorphic encryption scheme of Bonnet, Go, and Nissim. It's one of the early sort of, that was sort of pushing the frontier of the field at that point. And in general, sort of algebra sort of appealed to me, from the very beginning. So nice sort of interesting sort of tricks with algebra always appealed to me, and homomorphic encryption sort of fits right into the picture. So I've been sort of thinking off and on about it for a while.
So did you try to construct like the fully homomorphic encryption at that time, or did you just want to use it as an application for other things?
No, not really. So I didn't sort of try to construct fully homomorphic encryption, but interestingly, Ran Canetti and I were working on sort of trying to do program obfuscation. In fact, Ran had a long-standing interest on it, and sort of he suggested that we sort of think about it. And we had a sort of a half-baked sort of construction back then, assuming that there are these things called pseudo-free groups, which, I mean, didn't exist. I mean, I suppose we had sort of half-baked candidates back then, but they really weren't pseudo-free groups. But we sort of proved a sort of theorem saying if there are pseudo-free groups, then here's a way to obfuscate programs. So I guess one could think about it as sort of, you know, program obfuscation, as you know, is sort of computing on encrypted programs, right? So sort of computing on encrypted X has always sort of been in, at least in the peripheries of what I was thinking about, but I didn't directly try to do fully homomorphic encryption.
And then you went to IBM, and I guess there were a lot of folks there that were interested in homomorphic encryption. And is that how you got into it?
Indeed, yeah. So that was so the first few months that I was at IBM, I think it was 2008. That was around the time that Craig had come up with this breakthrough result, and everybody was and he did it, I think, actually when he was an intern at IBM, at least part of it. And you know, everybody was very excited about it. And I started sort of thinking about, so I guess I tried to read his paper and I couldn't understand what was going on, largely because of my own sort of lack of background, right? I have a very limited sort of set of tools that I work with. And then I said, can we replicate what is going on here with things that I knew at that point, which is the LWE problem or bilinear maps. So these are things that I was actually pretty comfortable with. And I started thinking whether you can replicate the effects of, Craig's sort of very algebraic techniques, in the sense, very sort of algebraic number theoretic techniques. Do you really need all that complication there? Can you sort of just do things from simpler algebra? So we started thinking about it. And I think at that point we came up with a way to do degree two homomorphic encryption. So that's sort of like exactly what Bonego and Nissen do, but we came up with a way to replicate that with lattices. Mm-hmm. So that's as far as I got, but I was thinking about it all the time, starting from when I got to IBM.
Got it. So it's interesting. So you actually tried to replicate the functionality of it using bilinear maps, and I guess that did not work out?
That didn't pan out very well. In fact, it's sort of like you start running a race and after 10 seconds you're stuck, you're stopped. So I didn't see where to go at all. But lattices was a different story.
Right.
So there, after some effort, we came up with a degree two homomorphic encryption, and we wrote this paper with Shai and Craig, and we even wrote a patent. I think that was my first patent application. So that was fun.
I see. And I guess today, FHE from a theoretical side is mostly, is it a solved problem, or are there still interesting problems that you think are worth pursuing?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I wouldn't call it a solved problem for two reasons. One, as sort of many people know, FHE is not a solved problem in practice. We've made sort of great strides in efficiency of fully homomorphic computation, but a lot remains to be done. Especially sort of if you want to do sort of general purpose computation on encrypted data, that is very much an unsolved problem in practice. In theory, again, I wouldn't call it solved at all. A problem this is my favorite problem is, can you actually get really fully homomorphic encryption as opposed to what people call leveled fully homomorphic encryption? Can you get like pure fully homomorphic encryption from the learning with errors assumption without making circular security type sort of, somewhat contrived kind of assumptions? So that's something that, I remember sort of declaring to Shafi, I think it was we were going to a DARPA meeting from Portland Airport, and we were sitting there, you know, it's late in the night, and I was like, very confidently declaring to her that, you know, this is just a matter of time. Give me a month, you know, I'm going to get it done. But it's been 8 years, so it's a very, very frustrating problem. And it's an important question. Mm-hmm. Like the foundation of fully homomorphic encryption, that would be great to resolve. And the other question is really, it's not clear to me why you need lattices. So really the only way to do FHE at this point is using lattices and the learning with errors assumption. Why? I mean, you know, you have so many other sort of algebraic structures out there. Why aren't we able to sort of, you know, get it done from those structures? That's a big sort of mysterious open question for me. Mm-hmm. So by far, I think we've made lots of progress, but in some sense, the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know.
So like you mentioned, fully homomorphic encryption is not solved in practice yet, right? Like we're not running, you know, systems based on fully homomorphic encryption yet. Yeah. And I guess from a theoretical side, it only, like you mentioned, mostly relies on one assumption, right, or one class of assumptions using lattice-based techniques. Do you think it's worth kind of reinventing fully homomorphic encryption from completely new assumptions that haven't been studied previously that may be a lot more practical, but maybe we have less of formal guarantees of what they mean, so that we can actually push the homomorphic encryption to the practitioners faster?
Yeah, that's a great question. And let me actually broaden your question a little bit. I think, you know, in cryptography, a lot of us, you know, at least sort of speaking for myself, we are a little bit circumspect about sort of making new assumptions. I suppose you could argue for a good reason, because, if you keep making assumptions willy-nilly, you know, the field is going to fragment and it's going to become, you know, it's going to go haywire. But, mm-hmm. But I do think that we have to be bold and courageous enough to make new assumptions, and that's how sort of big progress in the field is made. You can sort of start from the RSA, Diffie-Hellman and RSA sort of assumptions, I guess, at this point, right? But they were, you know, they were just sort of out of the blue conjecturing that certain problems are hard. I suppose they thought about it for a few months, but that's it. And then sort of, you know, it keeps going on and on with the decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption, with the bilinear maps, with, you know, with lattices and so forth. So sort of, you know, so I think making new assumptions, sort of trying to understand where sort of computational hardness, or rather sort of useful computational hardness comes from, is very, very important. I think that's something that has to be done. Someone sort of needs to. I think, you know, people have been sort of thinking about it. You know, can you get homomorphisms, sort of expressive homomorphisms, from other algebraic structures? And you know, there's no convincing answer at this point. But I don't think that we should give up. We should keep pushing.
Suppose we don't get an answer of construction of homomorphic encryption from more practical, I guess, assumptions. What is then the future of homomorphic encryption going to look like? Because, you know, like you said, like today, lattice-based constructions are not practical yet. So what has to happen in that direction until we can actually run systems on it?
Yeah, so barring a major sort of algorithmic sort of revolution in some sense in fully homomorphic encryption, there are lots of other things that you can do. You can sort of you know, one thing that I don't think we have fully sort of exhausted is the possibility of optimizing the existing sort of encryption systems. I think it was 2 years ago that Jung-hee Cheon and his group in Korea they came up with a different homomorphic encryption scheme. It's actually quite similar to what existed before, but it was different in a very interesting sort of way, in that it actually allowed you to compute with floating point numbers, with like real numbers, if you will, right? And that made a huge difference in at least a class of sort of practical computations that people wanted to do, in particular sort of training sort of machine learning models. So a progress that has a big effect on the state of the art doesn't have to come out of the blue. You know, it could sort of take existing systems and sort of look at them from an interesting sort of point of view, and that could already sort of make a big change. That's what this sort of development taught me. So that's sort of algorithms, and I think there is enough room to, there's still plenty of room to play with in the existing sort of LWE-based sort of constructions. And I guess the other thing that people have to do is they have to push the engineering side of things. And I don't think we have done nearly enough of that at this point. You know, looking back to like the early days of cryptography, of public encryption, I think one thing that several people did, I think, you know, my understanding is that also Ron sort of was thinking about this, sort of coming up with sort of ways to speed up RSA encryption in hardware. Right. So mm-hmm. That's a very engineering question. But sort of, you know, people really had to make progress on multiple ends, not just on number theory, but sort of, you know, software implementations, sort of better hardware implementations and so forth to actually get RSA to the point where it was practical. So I think a similar sort of large scale engineering effort has to be undertaken in the context of FHE as well. In fact, one could argue that the scale of the effort has to be an order of magnitude or a couple of order of magnitudes bigger, because it is actually dealing with computations as opposed to just sort of encrypting and decrypting.
Right. And I mean, I guess one of the problems is that you always break the computation by default, even when you encrypt it with FHE, and then you have to rewrite sort of the system from scratch. And, you know, as you're doing the computation, you don't know, you know, when to terminate, when to call another function, when to exit and return like some error message to the user, right? Like, yeah. It's a very different computational model that the entire like stack has to be adjusted to.
It's a very different computational model, indeed. I think what we need to do is to develop a sort of like a software stack. An encrypted computation stack from the ground up. So we need to come up with instructions, basic instructions to implement them well. Mm-hmm. We need to come up with libraries that do sort of algebra, let's say matrix operations and so forth. And then you just need to kind of build on top of it. Now, of course, like you said, there's a challenge of how do you support sort of branches and sort of, you know, computations whose runtime is data dependent and so on and so forth. These are inherently challenging for homomorphic encryption. But I think we can draw a boundary around a fairly large class of tasks that don't run into these difficulties and still are pretty useful in practice. So one could sort of think about it as sort of like TensorFlow, right? Which is a very sort of algebraic language. You could try to sort of implement a subset of TensorFlow, which is good enough for training machine learning models under the encryption. Mm-hmm. That makes perfect sense to me that can be done, but we're still sort of a few years of concerted effort away from it.
Got it. So you don't think of homomorphic encryption as ever being so generic that, you know, we run it in the cloud on AWS on every program that we push out there. It's more like it will be optimized for specific classes of tasks that don't run into these problems, especially around like branching or having to return like error messages to the users.
You know, never say never, right? I'm an eternal optimist, and I don't think I think homomorphic encryption will find its place in the world. It's not clear whether it's going to be sort of what you said, that level of generality, or it's going to be sort of tied to sort of machine learning training, for example, mm-hmm. or it's going to be somewhere in between. It's not yet clear to me. And in some sense, we are as a community, we're still sort of trying to find the killer sort of set of applications for homomorphic encryption. And I would argue that we're making good progress. So there's lots of sort of work on sort of building applications using homomorphic encryption and I think the community is making, I'm very happy to see the kind of work that's coming out of the community.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the other things that has to happen if you then want to rebuild the stack is you have to have, you know, enough funding and support, right, for these types of projects. Do you think there is enough support from the industry or from the world in general to continue funding for this, let's say, for 5 or 10 years?
Yeah. I think the answer is yes. Although, of course, you know, I don't want to declare this publicly because we could always use more resources and more money. A big chunk of early progress in FHE sort of came out from people who were sort of all working as part of the DARPA program called PROCEED. Which actually, Sergey, some of your graduate school funding came from PROCEED.
Thanks for putting it on the record.
So that was quite instrumental, and the program was very instrumental in actually driving early progress in FHE. You would hear about like the latest and greatest cold results in FHE by going to a DARPA PI meeting before you heard it from like ePrint or the conferences. So it was very, very sort of active sort of community. So that did a lot of good for the community. So following up on PROCEED, there have been a few sort of other programs that DARPA initiated that also sort of look at sort of more engineering kind of questions as to how to build applications using FHE and how to sort of actually make FHE programmer friendly. So these have been sort of going on. And now I think there is a program, there's an entire program that, you know, that focuses on building fast hardware for homomorphic computations. So these are all sort of like very, very sort of, these are all sort of really the right step in pushing the boundaries of FHE. We have to be sort of grateful to the US government and to the taxpayers at the end of the day.
Is there industry funding that's sort of sufficient for the space, or do you think it will be continue come from the government for a while?
So a lot of it came from the government. Industry funding, there is industry funding, of course, but the magnitude of it has been sort of like an order of magnitude less or more or less compared to the government funding. So they really have been pushing the envelope on this. And as you know, there are now several sort of startups that again try to make FHE practical. Full disclosure, I'm involved with one of these called Duality Technologies. And there the funding comes from VCs who listen to sort of the promise of this technology. They realize that it's not like building the next app. They realize that it's actually a grand goal. It'll take a few years to materialize, but they also realize that once it does materialize, its potential is huge. So that's another place where the funding comes from, but this is a very different kind of funding, as you can imagine. It's directed to actually getting a product out, as opposed to doing fundamental research.
So I actually want to talk a little bit about the startup, Duality, that you mentioned that you're involved with. Can you tell us a little bit about what the company's goals are? I guess it is related to FHE, right? But you have a concretely set of applications in mind or software that you're building?
Yeah. So I can tell you a little bit. So this whole thing kind of started by Shafi and I sort of trying to think, how can we take this really cool thing? And, when we give talks about FHE, we say cloud, cloud computing, and we are going to make it secure, yada, yada, yada. Is that sort of pie in the sky, or can we actually make it real? Mm-hmm. So then we started thinking, what are the domains where this technology could be sort of the most compelling? And we said, look, medical data is pretty sensitive. So let's try to kind of think about it. And in fact, we got, I'm not sure if the NIH, the National Institute of Health, if they invited us or we got ourselves invited, one of the two. But we went to DC and we gave a talk to these people who were researchers, who were program managers at NIH. And and they were interested. They were intrigued by the idea. But they said, look, you know, if you want to get government funding to the NIH funding to do this sort of thing, it's going to take a few years. It's not going to be a lot of money. You have to write this and you have to write that. Then we were sort of, I remember we were on the subway back to the airport and we said, look, you know, we probably need to do a startup. And I think, I remember we went there with a professor of biology at MIT called Chris Kaiser. And he said, look, you know, why don't you guys do a startup? And then we said, huh, okay. You know, at that point, at least I didn't have a beginning of a conception of what a startup is. And we said, yeah, okay, fine. Let's give it a shot. Then we sort of figured out sort of people who knew better than us how to write software, how to actually do business. And that's how sort of Duality came along. And what we do is so our systems are sort of built on top of an FHE library called Palisade, which is something that one of our co-founders, Kurt Roloff, runs and manages. And so that's sort of the technological sort of foundation, in some sense, software foundation. And we have sort of applications that come from several domains, the most important being finance and sort of financial crime being sort of a top concern. And there are sort of concrete applications there which call for sort of secure collaboration, which is, you know, accumulating sort of data coming from multiple parties, privately putting it together to do some analytics so that you can sort of gain more out of data. So there are several applications, concrete applications that come out of there, and that's sort of part of what we're focusing on.
Are any of those applications like deployed in the real systems, or is it still at the kind of testing phase?
Yeah, so we have prototypes that are running at our customers at this point, and we have more proofs of concept. So it's sort of at a stage where, you know, it's not like a product that we can sort of like ship off to sort of a lot of people and it'll solve a bunch of problems all in one. These are solving targeted problems. And they're at a stage of a prototype where we sort of work with the customer to understand what their needs are. And sort of we come up with a tailored solution for it. That's sort of the point. And simultaneously with sort of this product development, we are doing a lot of research within the company to make this Palisade thing actually better and better as we go along. We're also sort of, as a company, we're also sort of involved in the homomorphic encryption standardization setup, which you know because you were in the first meeting, right? So that's again progressing and progressing well, and that's that. It's a long haul. It's a marathon and not a sprint with this homomorphic encryption business, but you know, that's fun.
Nice. And so you're also a faculty at MIT, and so how do you balance your day to day life?
Quick answer: I don't balance. You know, it's like juggling 10 balls where you're capable of juggling two, you know. So, you know, you scramble at any point to sort of get things done. I don't do sort of day-to-day sort of business things for the company. That's taken care of by much better people than I am. Instead, sort of I work on sort of problems that come up from customers. Quite regularly, sort of, you know, our business people go to customers and say, look, what do you want? Here's what homomorphic encryption can do. And then that's a long dialogue. And then they come up with a sort of a self-contained problem and they say, look, can you solve it? And then we work on it with the technical team. So that's the kind of thing that I enjoy doing. I do enjoy explaining homomorphic encryption to people, but you know, after the 10th time, you know, it's a little.
Are any of those problems Do they end up as publications, or do you think they're mostly kind of engineering problems that you just need to figure out optimizations and algorithms?
So that's an interesting question. So they do end up as publications that I have written, I think, at least a couple of papers on problems that came up from the company, from the startup. They're a very different class of problems than what I'm used to and what I do in my sort of, you know, my sort of other parts of the research, in the sense that they are much closer to practice. They're directly motivated by sort of practical questions. There are also sort of problems that come up which are sort of broad, sort of interesting, conceptual, theoretical questions, which, you know, I wouldn't have thought of before. You know, these problems came out of sort of trying to distill practical questions that our customers ask. Mm-hmm. Of course, if we solve these problems, it's not like we are going to directly sort of apply the solution to what they want, but sort of their concerns kind of translate into concrete theoretical questions that that are interesting, they're intellectually interesting. So I didn't expect this to happen, but yeah.
So I want to talk actually a little bit about now MIT and the cryptography lab there in particular. So you were a grad student there at one point, and then, you know, you left for some number of years and then you came back. Could you tell us what was it like being a grad student? What is it like being a faculty? And is it the same lab? Have things changed since then?
Things have changed a lot and not so much. It depends on how you look at things. On a grand scale, what was sort of so exciting about being at MIT as a grad student was the peer group. You know, so I was a grad student at the same time as Yael Kalai, who we interviewed here. And Rafael Pass and Chris Peikert, actually, and a bunch of other people, and Susan Hohenberger, and a bunch of other people, intense in the best sense of the word. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all very passionate about what they were doing. They were very sort of collaborative, and we sort of, you know, we talked sort of research when we hung out for dinner, and, you know, it's very intellectually charged atmosphere. That mm-hmm. was great thing about being at MIT. And I think, you know, I suppose you have to ask the students now how it is, but I think that's sort of more or less sort of there, you know, it waxes and wanes, but you know, the peer group is what makes MIT special, I think. Mm-hmm. So that part hasn't changed a lot, I hope. But other things have changed. You know, faculty have changed. Of course, the students have changed. The setup has changed. The kind of problems we think about has changed. You know,
When you were a grad student, and if I don't know if you envisage yourself being a faculty at MIT or any other place, and once you got there, was it what you expected, or do you think it was very different from what you anticipated?
Oh, from grad school to MIT, to being a faculty at MIT?
That's being a faculty, yeah.
I'm not sure I expected much. I mean, I didn't sort of, I didn't really kind of sit and think about what it would be like. I kind of sort of took each day or week as it went. Mm-hmm. Was it what I expected? In a sense, yes. It was much more. It was intense. I knew that it would be intense. So that's something that you can guarantee about MIT. But it was intense in many ways, many different ways all at once. And that's not something that you experience as a grad student. As a grad student, you just think about research. You think really hard. You solve problems. But as a faculty member, you're supposed to, you know, as you probably know, play the role of a CEO and a CFO and a CTO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You have to play multiple roles all at once, and that's really an onslaught that you know it takes some time to get used to. Let me just put it that way.
Got it. So these days, what would you say is the breakdown of your time? Do you mostly spend it on, all the other things beside technical, or do you still find yourself having time to do research?
So these days I actually spend one has to sort of one learns this along the way. You either take a long time to learn this, or you're very quick to learn it, which is that your time is a huge resource, and you have to guard it with your swords and your bullets and your bayonets, right? You have to spend it. You have to be very careful about what you spend your time on. And I didn't realize it for a very, very long time, and now I'm sort of I hope I'm saying no enough times. If I say no twice a day, I'm actually very happy. So one has to actually really be mindful about what you spend time on. So I try to spend at least 4 full days a week on research, and if I do any less, I'm sad. If I do more, I'm happy. And I guess sort of there are four things in life. There is in my life. There's research. There's teaching, right? There's service, which is for all faculty members, and then there's family, right? And you can do two of these really well. Maybe you can do three if you're really like ambitious. You can do three really well, but not four. Not four. I'm yet to find a person that does all four well.
So which two then you're optimizing for?
Which two? Research and family. I think I had to, and the third priority would be teaching. Service. I don't know. You have to do what you have to do, but if that's what you do with your life, I think I'd be very unhappy.
Got it. And I guess maybe last question is, when you were finishing grad school, did you think of doing other things, or did you know that you wanted to stay in academia? I imagined, so most of Chaffee students, they went into academia, right? And I don't know if there was a, did you have a choice?
That's right. Yeah, that's a good question.
Did anyone ask you?
No, that's a good question. Actually, I hope Shafi doesn't mind me saying this. So she's very proud of the fact that late 90s, Akamai was formed, and a lot of theory students kind of left to join Akamai, and I guess they're doing very well financially at least now. But Shafi's very proud that none of her students left. So there's a sort of a culture in the group that you this is sort of you're here for the pursuit of knowledge, and that's it. So that's there. But I was maybe partly because of growing up in this atmosphere. I had a sort of a single track mind that I was going to go to academia, come what may. And I was very fortunate to that it actually worked out. It's really it's not for. It's not for everyone. You have to be extremely lucky to get it working out.
Well, this was a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
And
thanks. Yeah, you're great.